you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, and thanks for your patience as we managed to get everybody in. Everything we know is wrong. This is my favourite of the topics that was suggested to me when I knew that I was coming here. And it's about whether science can tell us what we want to know and whether science can really tell us the truth. You know, we do reach for science and we reach for a desire to understand and to be certain. But there was one recent paper that I think we might hear a bit more about in this debate, that 90% of some particular cancer research was not reproducible. So then the question is, can you actually rely on it? So should we see science as a flawed method and look somewhere else for our truths, or is it the only direct link to reality that we've got? And with us, we have some fantastic panellists to discuss this. And the debate will take the usual format, which is each of the panellists will have a few minutes to give an opening statement. And then we'll cover three particular themes. And then there'll be a bit of time for questions and comments from the audience. Let's go straight to our first speaker then, Kenneth Cook here. He's a data editor of The Economist. He's a former technology editor of The Wall Street Journal Asia and co-editor of Big Data, a Revolution that will transform how we live, work and think. And your question, as everybody's question, should we see science as a flawed method and look elsewhere for our truths?
Thank you. Thank you, Gabrielle. So science is a big topic. But the important thing about science and the scientific method is that it changes itself. We forget that because we think of the scientific method as one single thing, forgetting that over time, well, first there was a period in which we did scientistic things. We tried to understand cause and effect without a formal method. Then, post-Galileo, we created a scientific method. But that, too, has changed over time. Let me get to this idea of how it's changed in just a moment to first explain the idea why most of what we know or think that we know is probably false, is because we can't ascertain whether it's true or not, and the two are different. It's not that it's necessarily false, it's that we actually don't know that it is true. One argument for this, which we can talk about, is a statistical argument advanced by a fellow by the name of John Ioannidis. He's at Stanford, and what he's done is he's the one who first noticed that many of the studies that get published in scientific journals themselves have not been reproduced. They've either not been reproduced because no one has tried, because there's an incentive in science to create new findings, not simply to verify other findings, or because people have tried to reproduce it and have failed to reproduce it. Now, you might say that that doesn't mean that it's false, it just means that it was failed to be reproduced. However, you could actually now, after periods of time when you're taking landmark studies that if people have tried to reproduce many times over and failed to, you could then start to infer that in fact, indeed, it isn't correct. How bad is the problem? Well, it turns out that when Amgen, a large pharmaceutical company, tried to reproduce some landmark studies in cancer research, of the 53 landmark studies, they were able to reproduce only 6 of them. Likewise, in the case of Bayer, looking at other landmark studies related to drug compounds that they had created, they were only able to reproduce a quarter of those same studies. So in fact, that is the magnitude of the problem. It is a big problem. It turns out that statistically, not only will you find, if you have a certain probability value of what you will, of what you consider to be not happening by random chance, but what you would actually expect to happen because there's a real there, a real finding, you're going to have false positives and you're going to have false negatives, things that you think are true but aren't, things that you miss but really are true. And when you add them up, you could find out that as much as 2/3 of your findings may not be correct. Okay. The problem, though, that's a classical critique. The problem gets worse. It's big data. We increase the amount of data, we increase the amount of spurious correlations, sure, but it's not just that. You increase the amount of data so much, you can no longer share your data with other researchers. It's just sort of technically impossible. So science needs to build new institutions so that we can share this data, trusted third parties and intermediaries to allow that to happen, and to create a requirement that data gets shared. It's worse than that. The techniques that we are going to be using to try to understand reality and truth is something called artificial intelligence, is something called machine learning, and of that, deep learning. It works very, very well, but we do not know why it works, because you're dealing with so many variables, so many different weights, they're constantly changing over time, there's no explainability within the algorithm. So ultimately, we're entering a new world in which things are a bit relativistic. Not that it's wrong, it's just that we don't know that it's true.
Steve is the author of Humanity 2.0. He's a professor at the University of Warwick. He's a philosopher of science with, it says here, a postmodern take. And was interviewed by Richard Dawkins for Dawkins' documentary about the enemies of reason. So, Steve.
Well, first let me start by saying that Dawkins has a very liberal definition of what an enemy of reason is. So this is one of the reasons why I was included. I want to take up this issue of everything that we know is wrong and in a way deal with it in a complementary fashion from what Kenneth has just done, because I want to focus on the issue of theoretical error rather than error in terms of empirical observations and the conclusions we draw from it. Because there's a sense in which this kind of question in a way matters a lot for science, because science does have the aspiration of trying to explain everything, typically under some kind of a grand unified theory, perhaps of everything, or let's say of a particular domain of reality. And in a sense, that's kind of the gold standard for what science sets for itself as a particular form of knowledge. And it's there, it's at this sort of larger theoretical level that science has historically been most vulnerable to error. Okay. And I think this is kind of the starting point of the argument, because you might say, from a strictly from the standpoint of our contemporary theories of science, whether we're talking about our theories of life, our theories of physical reality, our theories of how society work and so forth, the Greeks got everything wrong. Okay. Other cultures routinely get everything wrong. If we're talking about that, and so in other words, in a sense, science is the only kind of form of knowledge that's in a position to make that kind of judgment. Nevertheless, as we well know, all these other cultures managed to exist perfectly well. They did perfectly fine for themselves, in a sense, even, and so there is a question here about what's at stake in everything that we know might be wrong, if we understand that to mean our fundamental theories. Okay, because that's in fact the part of science that is most likely to be wrong if we look at it historically. Because if you look at the history of science, one of the things that I think is pretty clear is we are accumulating empirical knowledge. Okay, and certainly the Greeks and other cultures have that kind of empirical knowledge. The knowledge that tells you that, if you walk out of a window, you're going to fall down. Okay, it's a theory called gravity that starts to explain it for you, but nevertheless, the basic empirical phenomena was well known as a regularity of nature, and you didn't need Newton for it. Okay, but science is claiming something more than that, right? Science is not just belaboring the obvious, which all cultures have. Science is making a greater claim to knowledge, which has to do with theoretical unification. And once again, that is where you see the possibility for error being the strongest. So in the philosophy of science, Hilary Putnam, famous Harvard philosopher, about 30 years ago now, came up with this idea of the pessimistic meta-induction. In other words, if you're looking at the history of science, what prediction can you make about the future of science? And the one prediction that you can make is that the major theories, the major unifying theories that we believe today in all the different disciplines will not be the same 100 years from now. We will still believe the basic empirical phenomena, the basic empirical regularities will still be largely kept intact, right? So in other words, the kind of knowledge, let's say in the case of physics, that's associated with engineering, That'll be constant. That might even accumulate. But what will have changed radically and what will have been declared to be wrong are the fundamental unifying theories. Okay? And so when somebody like Thomas Kuhn, some of you may be familiar with, talked about scientific revolutions, it's at that level, right, where the change happens, where you get radical ruptures, where one major theoretical framework gets replaced by another theoretical framework. Okay, and so from that standpoint, Kuhn liked to talk about in terms of the world changing. One doesn't have to go to that kind of extreme. Nevertheless, there's a fundamental sense in which everything that you used to believe at a theoretical level is wrong. The empirical phenomena is still there. It's still fine. But the theories are wrong. And we've got new theories. And often we need a new generation to take those theories forward. And that is a constant feature of the history of science. And so that's the sense in which I think we need to understand the idea that everything that we think may be wrong.
Lawrence is cosmologist and professor of physics at Arizona State University. His best-selling science books include A Universe from Nothing and my personal favorite, The Physics of Star Trek. And most recently, he's on screen in the documentary The Unbelievers.
I think what the two speakers just demonstrated that is that everything they think is wrong.
He already had that.
Let me try and change that. Let's see. The first point is that actually the article that was just that was discussed actually demonstrates how well science works, because of course what the journals were doing was science. They were trying to check the results, and they were able to determine that they couldn't confirm them. That meant that they know something about the original experiments. And so the fact that certain researchers produce results which are fraudulent or poorly framed and the fact that we can find that out is a good example of the fact that we can find out what doesn't work. And that's what science is all about. Science, by the way, has never been about finding out what's right. It's always been about finding out what's wrong. You can never prove a theory to be absolutely true. What you can prove is that it's absolutely wrong. By doing an experiment and testing the theory over and over again and finding out that the predictions of that theory don't match observations. And the way science works is kind of like Sherlock Holmes. Maybe early on, before people understood what the scientific method was all about, people might have thought it involved truth. But what it does is eliminate what's wrong, and what's left over has some element of truth. And then you keep exploring and trying to refine that. So science, in fact, our modern understanding of science is that there's no such thing as absolute scientific truth. That doesn't mean anything. In religion, there's absolute truth, and that, of course, doesn't mean anything either. The point, so empirically, the example that was given up from the Wall Street Journal is a great example of the fact that, yes, some scientific researchers make mistakes, some commit fraud, but we find that out. And in fact, publishing something in a journal has never been a guarantee that it's correct. It doesn't really mean much of anything except that it's been published in the journal. When I read physics articles in a journal, I look at some of them and I say, okay, well, that's not going to go anywhere likely. And I'm very skeptical. We should be very skeptical of what we read in scientific journals, just as we're very skeptical of what we read in newspapers and everywhere else. Now, so that's the first half. The second half, regarding this theoretical discussion that was just made, again, it doesn't quite match what we mean by theories. First of all, there's a well-established mechanism now for understanding how scientific quote-unquote truth evolves. It is not as if the theories that we now have will be wrong in the future, any more than Newton's law of gravity is wrong. Newton's law of universal law of gravity is absolutely right. It will be right. It was right then. It'll be right today. It'll be right in 500 years for describing the motion of cannonballs and rocket ships around the Earth. We use it adequately to describe all of those things to high accuracy. For the realm of phenomena that it was meant to describe, it's absolutely right. Now, it has been subsumed by general relativity at the extremes of scale, on large scales and high velocities. So what we understand is that our theories evolve, but the theories that describe phenomena accurately will continue to describe those phenomena accurately. They're not wrong. They're just subsumed in something else that can describe things over a larger set of scales. The best theory we have in nature right now is something called quantum electrodynamics, which is the theory of basically electrons and radiation. We can predict from fundamental principles, we can predict the results of experiments to 10 decimal plates, and we get them right over and over and over again. Now, we understand that electromagnetism, the quantum theory of electromagnetism, has been subsumed in something that's unified called the standard model. But so that allows us to push that theory beyond the realm in which it was meant to ultimately describe nature. It allows us to describe a greater set of phenomena than we could before. That theory, too, may eventually be subsumed by a broader theory, but the standard model will not be wrong in any sense. It's the best theory we have. And to describe phenomena up to the scale of the Higgs boson, there won't ever be a better theory, because it already describes things as accurately as you can ever expect to measure them at that scale. Ultimately, we might look at higher scales or larger scales and find we have to have a slightly different theory. So what we now know, and by know I mean theories that satisfy the test of empirical experiment, those things will never be wrong. They'll always be right, but they may be subsumed in a larger theory that then allows us to do more experiments. So that's my response to both of the statements so far.
The debate. Theme one.
So we're going to go now into the first of the themes, where we actually have a discussion, what may even be, if we were lucky, a punch-up, which is, does science uncover the truth? We will talk more about the scientific method in other ways, but we've got a few minutes now to talk about, does science uncover the truth? And Lawrence was just saying that he feels that it does in some sense, but first of all, what do you think?
The answer, of course, is sometimes. Yeah, sometimes science does uncover the truth. But I would use this question to respond to a few things that Lawrence said, because I'm perplexed by it. The idea that identifying the shortcomings of articles that have appeared being the benefit of science is definitely a rosy spin. But if you're identifying the error on the margin, then that sounds great. If you're identifying the fundamental problem with the process, then it actually calls into question the very process. And it seems that we are, if so many papers are not being reproduced simply because they cannot. Were that to be the case, then all these journals that published these research findings should publish research findings to say that it's wrong, and they're not doing that.
What issue do you think there is with the process?
Well, the process is going to be problematic in twofold. The first one is going to be statistically, the stats that are being used leave themselves open to greater error than the disciplines themselves admit. So you could have a lot. You could take the same amount of data and say, you know what, you believe that this finding is statistically significant and robust, but the fact is it isn't. We tend to think of scientific papers and science in general as finding out truth, but Lawrence is right, that actually it's the falsification principle, you're really finding out things that aren't true. But the reality of practical science in America, or in international academia, is that if you have a paper that proves that something's not true, you're not going to get it published, you're not going to get tenure, you're not going to get funding, and you're not going to get your own lab.
Is that really true? If there's a massive, major, important finding that someone can prove is not true, don't you think that would hit headlines?
Once a year, you'll get that headline. Better yet, you'll have, Bran causes, cancer to disappear, right? You're going to have not the falsification, you're going to have a verification finding. And that's the one that everyone's going to talk about, and that's what's going to get you tenure. And in fact, you're not even going to be able to get funding if you want to try to get these other, to try to falsify. So the Larry Lawrence's view isn't wrong, but it's very, very modern. Right, the idea of the falsification falsification principle. Well, it's just to say that it's a reinterpretation of the history of science, to say that and it's also an idealized form of science to say that we are only falsifying, we're not actually making claims, because the fact is everyone's making claims. But where I was shocked is this idea that if it's in a journal, it is only a guesstimate, and then we have to see over time whether the findings hold or not. I would say to Lawrence in an esteemed way, this is a peer-reviewed journal. Surely, if it's going to appear in the scientific process of peer review, that the findings, that has to be treated as legitimate and true. And if it's not, then again, we have to question the process of science.
Yes, I mean, I want to jump in on this point, because I think even people who are quite critical of peer review generally grant that if peer review has any strength at all, it's in catching error. Right? Peer review is not a process by which you you sort of promote creative thinking. Right? Any of you who've been through the peer review process will know that anything that seems a little unproven, a little outside of the ordinary, it'll get shot down just on the reason it's not substantiated. So if peer review has a strength at all, it's in catching error. And if we're in a situation where peer review isn't even catching error, then you can imagine, you can ask the question, where does the authority of science come from? Because I think Lawrence has an incredibly relaxed attitude toward this issue, right? Because, so there is this question here about what is at stake when we talk about scientific truth? Because to be honest, hearing Lawrence's answer, he's just talking about truth. Just like anything else, journals might be right, might be wrong. You have to see what pans out in time. Then what's so special about science under the circumstances?
Lawrence?
Well, okay. I didn't know where to jump in, but my tendency is to jump in, so I'm trying to avoid that tendency. Let's see. First of all, I hate hearing the word authority applied to science. There's no such thing as scientific authority. Let's get that clear right away. They're scientific experts, but they're not authorities. No one,
very subtle.
No one's view is not subject to questioning. That's the reason science works. No esteemed professor, no Nobel laureate, no anybody is above being proved wrong. In fact, I'm kind of amazed when I hear that you don't get tenure for proving something wrong. In fact, what we try and do as scientists is go into our office or lab every day and prove our colleagues wrong. That's how we get famous. That's how we get well known, by proving our colleagues wrong, by proving conventional wisdom to be wrong at some level, namely demonstrating something new. It is true that science proceeds by baby steps. It's not done by scientific revolutions and all of that common misconception. It's generally baby steps incrementally applied to what's done before, because people have been working very hard, very long in their whole lives on specific areas, and they make small contributions to knowledge. Now, I'm sorry that I surprise people by saying that things in journals are you have to read skeptically, but that's what you have to do. That's what scientists have to do. I mean, the point is that in magazines and newspapers, editors and fact checkers check facts and stories all the time, but a large percentage of the time they're wrong, and you have to read them skeptically. You have to read The Economist skeptically, just like you have to read Physical Review skeptically. Now, it is true that peer review does sometimes catch errors, and peer review sometimes works, in spite of the fact that all of us hate it. And that the fact that it's always true that the people reviewing your papers are idiots. unless they accept it. But the point is, it does help the process, but it doesn't eliminate fraud, for example. In fact, science doesn't handle fraud very well at all, because we assume researchers are honest. That's why it takes a long time often for scientific fraud to be discovered, because the presumption is that people aren't committing fraud when they write their papers. And if they knowingly are, it's an easy way to screw up the system. Now, it could be that, and there's no doubt that in pharmacology or pharmaceutical areas and certain areas of biology, unfortunately, because there's a great deal of money to be made, first of all, there's a great incentive for fraud. Secondly, the problem is that I absolutely agree. And as a physicist, I look at epidemiological studies and I find many of them laughable, because the sample size is 3 people or something like that. And that's a large sample. And it's very hard to make generalizations on the basis of that. And often claims are made that manifestly seem inappropriate. Physics, the biggest beta sets in the world, say the Large Hadron Collider, there's more data being generated every second at the Large Hadron Collider than there is in all the books in all the libraries in the world. But that data set can be handled. And the statistical claims of the discovery of the Large Hadron Collider were done at such a amazingly, our bar is so high, five sigma, et cetera, that we have great confidence in those results. And there's an example of the largest data sets in the world that are handled very well and are reproducible and, in fact, are therefore correct.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to IAI.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Theme 2.
The second theme, really, we've been talking about the science and uncover the truth. And the second theme is, if so many scientific papers turn out to be wrong, whose fault is it? What's gone wrong in that? And I think straight away you brought up something that I was hoping would come out of that discussion, which is we're saying scientific papers as if all scientific disciplines are equivalent. But perhaps there's some sense in which some scientific disciplines have more reproducibility than others.
It is true.
Well, it's clear, of course, that physics is better than all the rest, but let's...
Theoretical physics, indeed, quite.
Absolutely.
There is a wide variation there, and it is about the ethos of that discipline. I would bring up one point about authority, though, and science. The whole point, Lawrence isn't wrong, he's absolutely right. The whole point of science is to divorce authority from the individual. You divorce authority from the individual or the institution, where's the authority? The authority is in the process. Right, that's what the scientific method is supposed to do. And if the method's broken, right, if the method doesn't work, then authority, it's not that all the findings are wrong, it's that we don't know if they're wrong or not. The authority has a chink in its armor. That's the point. Lawrence and I are looking at the same glass of water. I see it as half empty. He sees it as half full.
Okay.
But hold on, there's a punch-up coming.
I can't see.
I agree this business that the authority of science lies in the process, and that the process is to a large extent broken. And I think Lawrence was alluding to the role that money plays in terms of causing people to kind of overstate and perhaps even radically, you know, falsify their own claims, you know, through fraud and all of that. And also now there's a greater incentive, though, and maybe this is to help Lawrence a little, there's a greater incentive to find this stuff out than there used to be in the past. So, in fact, we don't know really how much of past science has, in fact, been fraudulent because there hasn't been that kind of incentive to find out. But, of course, some historians of science do look at the working papers of people like Galileo and Mendel, and there is a very, you know, there is a view that's out there within the history of science community that those guys, by our standards, committed fraud. Okay. However, did it matter? And this is the interest. So there's an interesting punch. You know, what's the punchline, right? Is that to a certain extent, right? It may be possible for the scientific method to proceed, right, in a way that doesn't catch all the error, that actually does allow a certain amount of fraud to go through. You know, if, you know, you allow for a long enough period of time and other people to work in the process. And so when people have this very generous view of the scientific method as self-correcting, and I think maybe you began with that, that's kind of what they're referring to. Because I think at the moment, things look really bad for the scientific method, in part because there's a lot of incentive both for people to commit fraud and the people to find out about it. Right. So there's a sense in which, you know, if there's a lucrative contract in the pharmaceutical industry, you might want to check to see whether that guy's research really works.
Because then you can get the money.
Well, yes, exactly. As long as money's involved, there's an incentive to check error much more carefully than there has been in the past. But then what do we say about the past where there wasn't this kind of incentive and maybe there was just as much error being committed?
Lawrence?
Well, what we say about the past is were their predictions right or wrong? And that's, you know, it's, I don't understand. I mean, Aristotle was wrong. Galileo was right. And they're right because you can check that, you know, when you drop two objects of different masses, ignoring for air resistance, they fall at the same rate. For end of story. It's not a discussion of whether what his, you know, we can't go back and ask, did he actually perform those experiments? We can ask is the claim verifiable? And the claim is. So
but it took a certain number of years between the time Galileo first did his stuff and people were able to actually come up with the prediction you're talking about. So if Galileo were caught at the time, right, nobody would say, hey, give the guy a chance. Maybe somebody else who actually does the research can come up with the same result.
Yeah. I would make also,
I read
that.
Hang on, stands up pretty well to me.
So
all I can do is read what he wrote and the predictions he made. And it is absolutely true that, I mean, although I've gone to the museum in Florence to see some of his the experiments the materials he used, but the claims of that scientific publication are remarkable. One of the most remarkable books ever written by humans, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that. I want to simply point out that there's an inconsistency, Lawrence, in what you're saying, in which science is evolving through these incremental steps, standing on the shoulders of giants, and then the Kuhnian argument that Stephen put up, which is that actually, no, there's these revolutions in which the whole body of knowledge of what we thought to be true before is totally becomes obsolete, and actually now we believe this is the new theory. The point about Aristotle and Galileo is one, although it stretches centuries, as you pointed out, but the one between Ptolemy and Copernicus is a much more flattened version of it in which, you know, within several generations, the whole way in which we understood the world is wrong. And when we leave the domain of science, its lofty aims, and go into the here and now of engineering, technology, and we'll just take the area of medicine, the consequences of believing something that's wrong is catastrophic, right? And here in Britain, the famous example is of cot death. There was, you know, babies who would die just because, you know, terribly, we don't know why the biological mechanism is in place, but they do. And there are steps that we can do to mitigate that, although we're not certain if that works or not. But what was certain is that the language and the best practices that were handed down by the authorities in the 60s and the 70s and 80s turned out to be the exact opposite of what you'd want to do. And if I know the story correctly, so do check, this is probably unverifiable, or there is verifiable, it's just not true. But if I recall, the authorities were suggesting that babies should be placed on their front and not on their back, and that the incidences of cot death were actually greater of babies who were placed on the front, not the back.
What point is this making about whose fault it is? So if there were scientific errors, in that case, the science would uncover the correct way to do it and actually save lives ultimately.
Ultimately, it is simply to say that this idea of incremental steps that the union of scientists through the generations are holding hands, walking to the shiny hill, is just not true. In fact, the
we're arguing all the way to the shiny hill, and we're not holding hands, and that's the point. We all distrust each other's claims, and that's a good thing. It's called skepticism. There's no sense, by the way, in which and maybe I'm going back a little bit, but there's no sense in which the old theories are obsolete. Newton is not obsolete. Even epicycles were not obsolete. They actually, at the time, allowed you to predict the motion of planets.
But there's a difference between prediction and explanation.
Kepler came with ellipses that it became better. So the old theories are not obsolete in any way, in the sense that they continue to work.
They change their status. They're no longer explanatory theories. What they are certain kinds of empirical regularities that have been subsumed
Newton's
under larger theories.
Newton's an explanatory theory. I'm sorry. Newton's a very good explanatory theory. The force law between planets of the sun is 1/r² to high approximation. And until you get to very subtle things, Einstein is irrelevant.
Okay, so hang on. Now, hang on. So we're talking here about whose fault is it if and what I wanted to point out here is just I think it's just very interesting something that Lauren said, which is really we're not all walking hand in hand to the shiny hill. We're all arguing to the shiny hill and that's the whole point. And I think it seems as a lot of things that you've been saying are when you were saying that maybe people are deliberately fraudulent. I think there's also a whole scale of not deliberately fraudulent, but very human. The point is that we have a scientific method, which is very rational, and we have people who are doing it who are human and deeply irrational. And some of the most irrational people I know are scientists, my friends who are scientists. So there is something about that clash.
But that's exactly what the scientific method is designed to address, in the sense that indeed scientists are human. It's hard to recognize that every now and then, but we'll make mistakes, and that part of the central part of the scientific method is being skeptical. And therefore, if it's in some sense, if you ask who's at fault, the people at fault are, it's a combination of people who are extending the claims beyond what their data allows and people who believe it.
Theme 3.
So the question then is, the final question, the final theme is, should we look elsewhere for our truths? Or is science as good as it gets? We can slam into it, we can say it's done by flawed humans, but should we look elsewhere for our truths? Who wants to have a go at that?
Well, I'll start. I mean, I could say science is like democracy, you know, it's got a lot of flaws, but there's no better, right?
It's
better,
the worst method apart from all the others, right?
I mean, it's the only, look, it's, I would not only say, is it the best? It's the only method for uncovering the way nature works. There's no other method that works. And revelation certainly doesn't work. Any revelation that you have is wrong, to first approximate.
So the
only way to find out how nature works is to ask questions and let nature give you the answers. And that's what science is all about.
Kenneth, what do you think? Should we look elsewhere for our truths?
Sadly, no. Lawrence is right that.
Did you hear that, Lawrence?
Yeah, citing Churchill, that is democracy.
There's a but here somewhere.
Look, on that we can all agree. It's the weightings that we give to it. What's not recognized well enough is that there's a fundamental there's inherent problems in the scientific method.
Problems in the scientific method or in the application of the scientific method?
Well, both. Right. So in the application, of course, there is, because we've seen a lot of them and talked about them. But in the absolute method itself, all of science now is based on math. Right. It wasn't the case, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, there was math involved, but it wasn't a sophisticated level of mathematics. Statistics as a discipline really is only between 150 and 300 years old, depending on how you want to look at it. So that in the nature of the false positives and the false negatives is the fact that what a researcher is going to put forward, even the most well-meaning researcher, as a legitimate finding, is actually going to be potentially false. So unless within the process of science, there's baked into it verification of findings, of reproducibility of studies, we're potentially going down a blind alley. And again, empirically, we know this is the case. We've already crossed the Rubicon because we can see that so much of what's published can't be verified.
Steve?
A lot depends on what we mean by science. Because if what we mean is just the scientific method, let's say as Francis Bacon put it forward, which was largely as a kind of corrective to human cognitive biases and limitations, that was kind of the original context of what Francis Bacon was trying to do. You got fallible humans. How do you get to the truth? You go through this method of testing things all the time. That was kind of the basic idea. It seems to me that is very much part of every kind of form of knowledge. And I think one of the ways that you see this is that even when we talk about alternative forms of knowledge, whether we're talking about religious forms of knowledge or knowledge of other cultures, and science always is there as a kind of component, okay? And I think, so in a sense, the answer is obviously yes, science is kind of going to be part of any kind of knowledge process. I think the issue is going to, we go back to this authority question, whether in some sense what the scientific experts say about the application of science turns out to be the deciding factor in terms of what we should believe. But I think most people in most societies actually integrate some version of the scientific method into their thinking, including very religious people, okay? So I don't think, in a sense, at the very basic level, there isn't really a problem. I think it's really when we start to get to the question of whether there is some kind of special scientific authority, right, that in a way can invalidate You know, because I think that's kind of where the issue is. And I know Lawrence has been trying to avoid this issue of authority in science. But I think where this question starts to have some controversy is at that point, where in some sense science can override, you know, the scientists themselves can override. So if you have, for example, a religious person who reads a lot of science informally and has some kind of views about the way the world works, and they have some scientific content to them, and they even feel they're testing them, but they disagree very radically with what the scientific consensus on the matter says, right? I mean, that person's invalidated.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. If you enjoyed this debate and want to carry on the discussion, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.